But I want to cover a few general points to begin with. So the first thing we're going to look at is the quantum Zeno effect. I'm going to connect it into your questions on measurement. And most of you have probably seen this. There's a very common experiment to take a stack of polarizers and to show, of course, if I have a polarizer, it accepts one polarization. And if I put another one, then, of course, it's going to project that first the polarization from the first one onto the second one. And so we'll measure the cosine of that, right? And what John von Neumann suggested a long, long time ago was that if you put a continuum of polarizers where you're just rotating very slightly, then you could rotate the states without actually attenuating anything. So of course, clearly, if I put two polarizers back to back at 90 degrees, then okay, I'm going to lose my signal, lose the light. But if I rotate them slowly, then I don't do that. And how many of you have actually seen that? A few. Yeah, good. Okay, so let's spend a couple of minutes looking at it. So the only thing that we're saying is, okay, I have a state, and of course it has to be a known state, right? If you're looking at this at a quantum Zeno effect, you're going to save a state. So we need to have a known state. So we start off with some particular state. And then we're going to have a measurement operation, and the measurement operation is going to be as a function of some angle. And since I've defined the state, let's say this is along the z-axis, then I'll take my measurement operation to be a rotation from that state. So we'll rotate about sigma y. I just need to rotate about something that's orthogonal to it. Okay, so now I've defined a rotated measurement operation. And of course, what happens? Well, we apply this measurement operation, and formally we say that what we get out of this is the trace, of course, of that. And that tells us, of course, the amplitude. It tells us. In addition, we say, well, what's the final state? The final state is the measurement, right? We end up in the measurement state. Yeah? And if I have many, many, many of these, why does it work? Well, it works easily because this looks like cosine of theta. And if I let's say that we want to rotate from 0, 0, I want to go to 1, 1. Right? And so I want to do this many times. And so we'll take cosine of theta to be cosine of pi over n. The number n is the number of steps we do in the quantum Zeno effect. And of course, we need to do this n times. And this becomes very approximately 1 as n becomes large. Yeah? Okay. And let me not even show it. I'll send you a Mathematica notebook, but it doesn't say anything more than that. Now, this looks very much like our strong measurement model, right? This says, hey, I take some state, and I make a projective measurement, and I get out the state and some overlap with that state. And what I'd like you to show is that it wasn't required that this be a projective measurement. In fact, the only thing that's required of seeing this rotation by the quantum Zeno effect is that we apply a Krauss map which is dephasing about the measurement axis. Okay? So take this, and instead of a strong measurement, apply a dephasing map. About the measurement axis. Okay? So you can apply a Krauss map. I want it to be completely dephasing. All right? You can look at what happens if it's not completely dephasing. And experimentally, this is a lot closer to what happens than to say, hey, you've collapsed. Where do you collapse? Well, you collapse in a situation like the neutron interferometer, where you're actually absorbing a neutron, right? But if I take the NV center and I say, well, let me project out in the NV center, in other words, let me take some photons from the cycling transition, okay, then we pick up phases, okay? So we pick up a dephasing operation. Okay, now I want to, this piece is old and not so, it's important to understand, but it's a bit too basic. Now I want to go back and look at specifically at the NV center, okay? And we want to use the quantum Zeno effect with quantum error detection, okay? So this is an experiment that Osama in my lab is considering doing on the NV system. So let's have a look at how we can combine quantum Zeno effect with error detection to keep an arbitrary state. The quantum Zeno effect is wonderful because it, for low resources, says all you need to do is be able to make a measurement. If you can make a measurement, then you can keep a state, or you can rotate a state. But it's just pretty lousy for quantum computing, because I needed to know what the state was. Okay? So it says, hey, with a lot of effort, I could do classical computing with more errors and a lot slower than on any other device. And what we'd like to do, of course, is to think that we could do something uniquely quantum. So let's keep an arbitrary state. Okay. So now we'll take an arbitrary state. And you'll allow me to add one more spin and ancilla. So that those of you that had Dan's course, this will be familiar to you. And we're going to correlate those two. So what we'll do is conditional on the first bit, the one of interest, I'm going to rotate the second one. Okay, so this is a controlled NOT gate. And we're rotating the second one conditionally on the first one. And so at this point, we end up with the state alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1. So we end up with potentially an entangled state depending upon what alpha and beta were, right? Potentially. And now here I'm going to allow some error. And because I'm at the moment just looking at a small code, the physics would be exactly the same if I looked at a larger code. But we take up a few more boards to describe. So we're going to look at a small code with a simple error. And the error is that we allow sigma x on any of the qubits, any of the two qubits. Okay. So now we have this state. And of course, there's three things that can happen. One, there can be the nice thing that nothing happens. Or we can have a sigma x operation on the first qubit. Or we can have a sigma x operation on the second qubit. And you'll recall, perhaps, that if we're looking at error-correcting codes, we're looking at the codes for the generators of the noise. So I'm not going to allow a code that that has multiple errors. But you're going to show me later that, in fact, you can take care of that. Okay? But here's the errors. So no error, sigma x1, sigma x2. Yeah? Okay. Then I'm going to decode the state, and we'll do it exactly the same way we did before with another control NOT gate. And so if the control NOT gate is its own inverse, and so if there was no noise, we end up back where we were. And let me just write it out. Separating the ancilla. Here, okay, what were we going to do? Well, we're going to end up with 1, 1, and 0, 1. Right? So we'll end up with a state that is alpha 1 plus beta 0, tensor 1. And here we'll end up with 0, 1, and 1, 1. So in this case, I end up with alpha 0 plus beta 1, tensor 1. Yeah. And now you see that you can look at this a few ways. One, you can say, well, if I have an error, the error changes the parity of the state. Okay? So if you're a computer scientist, you like that. The other way you can look at it, and of course, the control NOT maps the parity into the second bit. Okay? The other way you can look at it is to say, oh yes, I can use the ancilla as a flag of if there was an error. Now notice, it doesn't give us enough information to correct the error, right? Because if there was an error on the first qubit or an error on the second qubit, we get exactly the same result. Okay, so we can't correct the error here. But we do know if there was an error. And nicely, we know if there was not an error, right? If the ancilla is 0, then there was no error. So now you can see what we would like to do. What we want to do is use the quantum Zeno effect. We're going to use the quantum Zeno effect to keep us in the zero manifold of the ancilla. So we want this time to be short. This better be short compared with the error strength, right? Because that's going to look like this angle. Yeah? And then we're going to make a measurement of the ancilla. And if we get the zero state, well, then we know that we did the right thing. But we're applying the quantum Zeno effect. So what's this if statement? We don't do any if statement. All we do is we keep resetting the ancilla to zero. Okay? So here, at this point, we don't make any measurement. A measurement is absolutely useless in this case. Just reset the ancilla to zero. And repeat that over and over and over again. Yeah?
So if the ancilla is not zero, we just whatever.
We just reset it to zero. We don't ask the question. We just reset it to zero. Okay? Now, of course, remember that's in quantum computing, right? Quantum computing doesn't come with a promise that every time you run a sequence, you get the correct answer. It comes with a promise that there's a high probability that you get the right answer. So you can get the wrong answer occasionally. It doesn't make any difference, right? But you can control the probability with which you get the right answer.
Yeah.
And that, of course, depends upon your knowledge of what this error is. Okay? So now let's map this onto our NV center. So remember, yeah, please.
What if you make to reset the semantic state zero? You'll still have an error.
So let's look over here. Okay? So now I'm projecting. I keep doing that, right? And you can say, hey, if you don't project fast enough, you still have an error, right? Okay? And you say, well, how big is that error? It's the difference of this from one. And if I want the error smaller, that's okay. I make n larger. Yeah? So I will show you this thing. So here, I start with an input state, which is a pure state pointing up. And we define an operator for measuring the purity, because that's going to be our measure at the end of the day. I give us a measurement operator, which is a rotation about y, okay, of the upward projecting projector, upward pointing projector. Okay, so we see what the general form of the measurement operator is. And then we just go through and apply it. So I make a measurement. So I measure the overlap of the operator, the measurement operator with some output state. And, of course, the state that it ends up with is an attenuated version of the measurement operator. Yeah? And we just keep doing that, and if I look at 100 steps, we see that the purity falls off. If I look at 200 steps, the purity falls off more slowly. And this is, no, here, this is the only plot that matters. If I look at the rotation from plus Z to minus Z by von Neumann's measurement by rotation, it's the title of his paper, rotation by measurement, sorry. Then you see that if you take 100 steps, you get a little bit inside the Bloch sphere. If I take 200 steps, I'm closer to the surface of the Bloch sphere. And of course, the number gets closer and closer and closer. And the purity that you're going to end up with for the final state, again, just goes as cosine of the angle that you're rotating by to the number of steps that you're applying. And so it gets quite close to one. So yes, right? This is not one, right? But the errors are controlled by you. They're controlled by how you set up the experiment, okay? And that's the same thing. That we have over here. What you're going to show me is that with this system, we can make these amplitudes small. They're always going to go as a cosine, right? If I'm looking at, you know, that's a nice thing about quantum mechanics, it's linear. So if I look at an error, it's always going to go as a cosine. And of course, what happens is that the first part of the cosine is flat, right? And so we can suppress these as much as we want, and we never have to actually correct anything. That's the beauty of the quantum Zeno effect. We simply have to keep projecting ourselves into the correct basis. Okay? And so how do we do that over here? what we've got the NV system, so the electron spin quantum numbers, the intersystem crossing here, remember it decays only to the zero state. And so here, the mapping that I would use, it need not be this, but it's the mapping I would use, is I would take the ancilla, and I would map that to the electron spin. And you have to choose something, right? So I'll use MS 0 and plus 1 states. Right, so now I have a two-level system that I can map the ancilla to. Okay, and the system has coherence. So life is good. Remember, that we can have a nuclear spin. In this case, it's a C13. That has an effective Zeeman splitting in these manifolds. Right, the Zeeman splitting came from this funny physics of the hyperfine interaction. Okay, but it doesn't matter too much. All it says is that, hey, I can treat this piece of the electron spin as having a Hamiltonian, which here I'm going to map into just this manifold. I'm going to forget that there's this manifold. So I have a fictitious spin 1/2 particle. And I say, okay, I have some sigma z electron interaction. Here, I have some sigma z nuclear interaction. And the energy separations in these two levels are very different. So let's just take it that we have a coupling that is that is sigma z electrons sigma z nuclear plus sigma z electrons sigma x nuclear. Okay, we'll just take that as a Hamiltonian. And how do we do the experiment? Then we say, okay, I'd like to know that the electron spin is always in the zero state. But we saw that if I apply the laser here, we apply a laser pulse, that the system gets excited. If it's in the zero state, it falls back down to the zero state, 30 nanoseconds. If it gets up, it's in the plus 1 state, it falls back down again to the plus 1 state, again with a time constant of 30 nanoseconds. But a third of the time, it goes over to this inner system crossing state, and there it falls down with a time constant of 300 nanoseconds. So all I need to do is apply the laser. If I apply the laser, I know that I'm going to end up in this state. Okay? So no measurements. It doesn't matter that there's photons coming out or not. You just apply the laser for a time longer than 300 nanoseconds. And now you know that you're back in the zero state. Okay? And the only requirement is you do have to, of course, carry out these control not gets. Okay? And so you say, yes, I need to use this interaction. We'll talk about that next week. Next week, later on this week, for generating those control not gets. Okay? And we just keep coming back to zero state. Now, have I convinced you or not? Yeah? Okay. Yeah?
Which one is the, so that's the answer.
Right. The C13. This is our qubit. And the rest of this is just to give us a measurement. Yeah, so let's look at the Hamiltonian. And then let me take this picture and redraw it over here. Right, because here we've said we'll look at a small number, a small number of the energy levels, and we'll map them into qubits. And this mapping is called a fictitious spin formalism. It goes back to the 50s, so before there were qubits. But it's the same logic. So I say, OK, I want an electron spin that looks like a spin 1/2. So we're just going to take these two energy levels. We're going to forget that there's this ms equals minus 1. Remember that if I was describing the Hamiltonian for all of this, then I would have said that the Hamiltonian is equal to the zero field splitting times sigma z times sz squared of the electron. Right? That was the zero field splitting. We saw that if I had two spins and they were exchange coupled, two spin 1/2 particles, we would end up with that piece. But now I don't care about it. I only want that piece. So then we say, OK, I've got an electron spin, which in the actual device, the physics looks like this. But here, we're going to say, it looks like this. And that there's a energy separation here, which we've defined as omega e. Okay? And then we say that, look, we've got this additional piece. And let's take this piece here that says, well, if the nuclear spin is up or down, so now I have a state here. So this was minus 1/2. So we had a state of the electron like this. But now then we say if the nuclear spin is down or up, there's an energy separation. Right? So this is omega nuclear. And then we say there's a further shift. There's a shift by sigma z of those two, right? And so that will take us like this, right? If the spins are anti-aligned, it's negative. If they're aligned together, it's positive. And so the difference here is given by j over 2. And we still have this nice quantization. And then this term here mixes the states, right? So that last term says that will get two more states. Which are given by the mixtures of those two. Because the sigma x operator on the nuclear spin, it doesn't commute with, of course, the z quantization axis. So the sum, once you get to this term, the sum of sigma z is no longer a good quantum number. Yeah, so that comes from the hyperfine interaction. So remember that the hyperfine interaction had two pieces to it, right? The through space dipole-dipole piece. and it had a piece which is a through bond Fermi contact piece. And the through bond Fermi contact piece is isotropic, so it goes as sigma dot sigma. But the through space piece is anisotropic. And so you have a full tensor interaction between this. Okay? But you don't need all of this for what I'm asking you to do here. Okay? Here, I'm saying, forget actually how you apply these controlled NOT gates. Just take it that you can apply those in no time. So take it that you apply that operator for the controlled NOT gate. So UC NOT is equal to that. Yeah? You have a question?
Yeah, sorry.
Don't be. Oh, thank you. What I mean is that the states mix. So the state here is a linear combination of this state and this state.
Okay.
So remember that we had in the strong coupling case, we were looking at the case where we had delta omega sigma z a minus sigma z b plus j sigma a dot sigma b. And there we saw that that we went from a state where we had four energy levels as we increase j, as j over omega, the arctan of that goes to pi. Pi over 2. This went into a state that was okay, so here, of course, sigma z is no longer a good quantum number. And these two states were mixed together to form this.
Okay.
Yeah?
So when you say that your answer is zero, you mean it's
so fortunately, in this case, the ancilla qubit, which is the electron, sigma z is always a good quantum number. Okay? So what I mean is that we get back to this state of the electron. And we have some states of the nuclear spin here.
Oh, I thought you said the nuclear spin is the ancilla.
No, sorry. The electron spin is the ancilla.
Oh, okay. The nuclear
spin is the qubit.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So when a qubit is zero, you mean it's the mixed?
So when the electron is zero, as long as we keep the electron in the zero state, we'll maintain the C13, the qubit, in an arbitrary state. We don't know what it is, but we'll maintain it in an arbitrary state.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, that's what we want. We want to be able to suppress errors without actually knowing what this state was. Yes.
So in that big picture,
yeah,
you would have the electron to be zero and the qubit to be, let's say, one. It would be, which line would it be?
So, we would just make a mapping here. We say, this state, whatever it looks like, I'll call that 0, 0, and I'll call this 1, 1.
Yeah.
Now, you're probably alluding to the fact that, hey, if I look at the quantization axis here, it's different than the quantization axis there. And we need to pay attention to that. Okay, you don't need for this problem, but if we're doing an experiment, we need to pay attention to that. And I'll talk about that, but it won't be till tomorrow. All right, but you're to put words in your mouth, you're exactly right for what you didn't say, that, that the quantization axes are different. And so there's a similarity transform that the nuclear spin system sees a different quantization axis depending upon the state of the electron spin. And if we neglect that physics, we neglect it at the cost of fidelity. Okay. All right, so this is a lot of things, and let's go back to just setting up the problem, because we've gone through a lot of physics over here, which is nice physics, but it isn't the physics you need here. Okay, so what's the physics you need here? Is to say, one, that you understand this quantum error detection code. And that, you know, this piece here, I'm pretty sure you do. I hope so. And of course, if I want an error here, we can generate the error with the Krauss map, right? So life is good. And we know that we have this unitary. That's all good. And then we wanted to add to that that this is one step in the quantum Zeno case. In this example, I was using the quantum Zeno to rotate the state, because I wanted to show you that the quantum Zeno effect was robust to noise, and the effect of noise was the rotation of the measurement operator. Over here, there's no rotation, right? We apply the same measurement operator over and over again, and all we ask is that if I look at the error as compared to the time that I reset, and you say, okay, well, what's the error? The error, we know that it's going to be given by a Krauss map, and it's going to look like and P is going to be T over some time. Let's call it T1. Right, so there's a parameter that we have to input in here, because there's a probability, there's a rate at which the errors occur. And just to keep this consistent with the block pictures we've looked at, we'll just label that time T1. Yeah? All right. Good. Now, as I said last week, this diamond in V system is being looked at by many, many groups. And I wanted to go over quickly the way we look at any quantum system, because I want to get to a point of decoupling, another way of removing errors. Okay, but to do that, I need to add a few terms. So if we have a quantum system, we have some quantum device that we've mapped into qubits, and I want to parameterize it. So the first thing we do is we look at preparing the 0-0 state, and we ask, what is the probability that we can prepare this? And of course, it should be very high if we're going to have a quantum processor. The second thing we do is to take this, and we want to measure the so-called T1 relaxation, again, going back to the block sphere. The T1 relaxation says, how long does this state live? Right? And the, so we want to measure the lifetime of that, of 0, 0. And typically, so this is T1. And typically, we'll apply a pi pulse about the x-axis so that we'll take the state 0, 0 to 1, 1. And we'll look at the recovery as a function of time. This isn't always appropriate, but it's just the most common approach. And so if I look at the expectation value of sigma z, of course, here it starts off at minus 1, goes to plus 1 under the action of resetting the qubits. And if it's an exponential process, then this curve looks like so. And we can measure a rate with that. The third thing that we measure is a Rabi oscillation. And, okay, it's jargon, but it's jargon that's used by everybody. So what a Rabi oscillation says is that I apply, instead of a pi pulse, a theta pulse about x, and we make a measurement directly after. And we're going to measure along z. So we'll start off here, again, with the state 0, 0. And what we should see is an oscillation as a function of theta. And this relaxation time is given by T Rabi. Now you'll see why that's important in a second. Let me skip to the next one, which is called the Ramsey fringe. Ramsey is a good scientist, long dead. But he's a bit of a schmuck, too, because, I forget his name. The Dutch scientist who actually found the NMR first comes to Ramsey's lab, suggests the experiment to Ramsey, sets it up with Ramsey, goes home. Ramsey does the experiment and publishes it without him. You say, hey, man, you could be more polite than that. All right. So we start off with 0, 0. Yeah?
So in the Rabi picture, what is the x-axis? Theta?
Theta, yeah. So the nutation angle about which we rotate that. Okay, so here we're going to rotate the system and allow it to undergo what's called free evolution. The word free here means that we're not applying any driving field. We're just allowing it to evolve as it will. And then we want to rotate it up, because if I drew this in a block picture, right, we started off along the z-axis. We gave it a pulse about y, so we went over here to the x-axis. And then we're assuming, in this case, in fact, in all of these cases, that there's some noise about z. And so something will happen in the xy plane. And then we're going to rotate that xy plane back up so that it projects along z, so I see a signal. Okay, so I'm going to take this plane here, this plane, And we're going to rotate it so that it overlaps the z-axis. So, of course, you know, if there was no motion, it just stayed there, we would see just a flat. If there's a rotation of this, then we'll see a cosine function. If there's a rotation and noise, then we'll see a damped cosine. And that's what we see. In the Ramsey fringe, we see a damped cosine oscillation. So this is a function of time. OK, all of these are measuring the expectation value of sigma z. Yeah?
So the second pi by 2 pulse should be minus?
Yeah. Usually isn't, in fact. Just because there's something nice about giving the same pulse twice. But then I should have made a from the start from the negative. So yes, that's the way it should go. And this is e to the minus t over t2 star, sometimes called t Ramsey, but more often t2 star. And so remember that we've defined a qubit. So there's a Hamiltonian that looks like, this is called omega sigma z. Right? There has to be an energy if we're defining a qubit. So that's the energy. And these oscillations, that's 2 pi divided by omega, right? So omega is the Ramsey frequency. Now, this was observed early on that experimentally T2 star is much, much less than T1. This isn't a requirement, this is just an observation, a typical observation. Let me say typical, because and you saw in your taking the Krauss operators to the Bloch equations that T2, right? This is the T2 time, that T2 is equal to T1, right? That's what you got from your Bloch picture. And if T2 is equal to T1, then T Robbie is equal to T1 as well, right? Because T Robbie is taking the state from being along Z to being in the transverse plane. So T Robbie, 1 over T Robbie, is 1 over T2 plus 1 over T1. So spending half the time in each. And get half there. And so this thing is just equal to 1 over, since T2 is equal to T1, this is just equal to T1. So that's, again, simple theory.
So a very naive question. What is the noise here? What noise are we?
So we haven't defined it yet.
Right.
All we've said is that it's about the z-axis.
Okay.
Yeah? Now notice, in this case, right, since the signal is in the xy plane, we expect the noise to be about the z-axis, and we have this interaction, right? So it's processing. So if there was noise in the x or y plane, it would average that out, unless the noise was a very high frequency. Here, there could be an extra noise. There could be noise along the x-axis, right? Okay. So now let's talk about Tieber's question more. So Hahn thought about this. In fact, Hahn, very, very creative physicist, and a good engineer. And what he did was he was the first one to show that, that he could apply two pulses. You know, you think that's pretty easy today. In the 50s, to have two pulses of RF was a tricky thing. And what he saw was an echo. So we're going to describe his echo and relate it back to here. Okay? So what Hahn did was this experiment. He took the Ramsey experiment and he placed a pi pulse right in the middle. Okay? So now then, instead of tau, we have tau over 2 on both sides. And let's look at what happens to this. During this time here, we have an evolution that looks like e to the I omega noise of t tau divided by 4 sigma z. Right, so omega n is just, we're going to define it as a noise. And we could describe a incoherent distribution of noise, right? We saw that in the neutron case. So it's just like in the neutron case that there could be a distribution underlying this. But at the moment, I'm just going to look at one particular value of it, okay? And then, over here, we would have the same sort of noise, so the same operator. Yeah? But of course, there's this pi pulse in between. And a nice way of looking at it, it's not the way that Hahn looked at it, but a nice way of looking at it is to define an interaction frame. Based on that pi pulse. Okay. And so that I can say, oh yes, I have one interaction frame here. This is frame A. And then I have another frame here, frame B. And then I'm going to forget about this pulse, right? All I need to ask is how these two frames are related to each other. Okay. Well, if I have this piece here, the Z interaction, and it's transformed by a pi pulse about the Y axis, that takes Z into minus Z. Right? So in, now if I extend this frame to effectively remove the action of the pi pulse, this term picks up a negative sign. Right? Because e to the I pi over 2 sigma y sigma z e to the minus I pi over 2 sigma y is equal to minus sigma z. Right? That's the only piece I'm doing. So now that I know how to add these up, okay? So now I can say, oh, well, the effective action of the noise is the products of those two and almost right now you want to say, oh hey, I know what to do here, and this thing is equal to the identity, notice, outside the box, and therefore no noise. there was a big assumption we made. So this stuff is exactly true. This piece is exactly true. But I need to put a prime there. To say, oh, I'm looking at the noise at this moment in time. And here I'm looking at the noise at this later moment in time. Okay? And if the noise is the same, if this is static, so if omega n is equal to omega n prime, therefore the noise is static, then the Hahn echo removes the action of any noise. Okay? And we get a big signal here, and life is good. And so we make a plot of sigma z versus tau. And what we see is that we have over here T2 star and T2 Hahn is above T2 star. And of course, the limit of T2 Hahn is T1, just like the limit of T2 star was T1, right? And we get closer to it if the noise is static. Yeah? Okay, now, this isn't a really nice way of measuring what happens with the noise as a function of time. Because you can see what happens. We keep expanding the time we're looking at. Okay? So there's a better approach to measuring the spectral density of the noise. I'm going to talk about that tomorrow since we're out of time today. But let me show you the way that Hahn looked at this. And the first thing is, when Hahn looked at this experiment, he couldn't apply the sequence. He could apply multiple pulses, but they were all the same length. I'll leave that up. I'll do it over here. So the actual Hahn echo was an echo that was 90 degrees and 90 degrees. And he described it geometrically. And before I do that, which I will do, let me describe how he described this experiment later on. So this isn't from his original paper. This is from a Physics Today paper he published many years later. And the way he described it, so we're just looking down on the xy plane. And we know that the noise, omega n, is about the z-axis. And we know that after this pulse, we've aligned the state along x. So then he said, well, it's very much like running a race, that you run a race, and at this moment you say start, and the runners run off. And depending upon, that won't happen. Depending upon the strength of the noise they see, they process by a different amount. Okay? At this point, where you give a y pulse, what do? You just flip this plane upside down, right? So all I'm going to do is apply a 180-degree rotation about this plane. and we end up in the state, in the case, right? So now this is the x-axis, just like the transformation we applied over there. And we had something like that. Yeah. But the spins, if the noise is the same, the spins will keep evolving in the same direction they evolved before. So at this point, they keep evolving back. So they all end up just retracing their steps. And at this time afterwards, everyone's back where they started off, and life is good, okay? Under the assumption that there's no noise. Yeah? Okay, so quickly, what does this thing look like? This says we give a pi over 2 pulse about why we end up in this transverse plane. The spins dephase. So the spins go everywhere, just like we're showing here, except they go everywhere. After some time tau later, we give a 90-degree pulse about this axis. So I take this plane and I tilt it up. And now they keep processing. And at the time tau later, you can calculate this. It's a real drag to show it geometrically, but it's easy enough to calculate it. The spins end up back. The component of them that was in the transverse plane rotates correctly back to where they should. The pieces that were along z, of course, they have to stay there, right? Because there was no possibility of them rotating because the noise about z. So they just stay there. And so you end up with this figure 8 type structure on the surface of the Bloch sphere. And if I look at the intensity contribution here, it's 1/2. And why is it 1/2? Because we're integrating cosine squared of omega nt, right? So that's a, this you'll see easily. It's very easy to convince yourself that any two pulses will give you an echo under a DC, under a constant noise. Okay, constant noise, any two pulses gives you an echo. They always look complicated like that, but for a pi pulse, it looks really simple, and life is good. So this is actually the Hahn echo, but if you look in the literature, people will use the term for this. Okay? All right, so let's stop here. What I'm going to do tomorrow is two things, I hope. One, I'm going to show you what happens as I apply a periodic array of pulses. If I apply a periodic array of pulses, it's very nice because I choose a frequency. And so then we can ask, what is the noise power at that frequency? So a very important parameter to understand as we try to develop the control we need for a quantum information processor. And the second thing I'd like to do is to describe how you could use an NV center for a quantum repeater. Okay, so we'll look at that too. And you're going to work out, they're going to work out this quantum Zeno effect with quantum error detection. All right, questions? Yeah.
Yeah, the Hahn echo is an early version of a quantum error correcting code, or?
Yes, it is. It's a dynamical code because you need to keep applying these pi pulses, but it's efficient at suppressing certain types of errors. Yeah. And although we tend to think of quantum error correction, that which will become dynamical decoupling, the stuff that it erased, which is a quantum error correcting code, and then noiseless subsystems and equal huge free subspaces, we tend to think about them as different, but in fact they're all part of one simple picture. Yeah? Good.